The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am honored to welcome back our guest this afternoon. When David Grossman won the 2017 Man Booker International Prize for his novel, A Horse Walks Into a Bar, the selection committee chairman said, "David Grossman has attempted an ambitious, high-wire act of a novel, and he's pulled it off spectacularly. We were bowled over by Grossman's willingness to take emotional as well as stylistic risks. Every sentence counts, every word matters in this supreme example of the writer's craft." This is not an atypical response to Grossman's writing. Gary Steingart called the book a magnificently comic and sucker punch tragic excursion into brilliance. Born in Jerusalem, Grossman is the author of numerous works of fiction, nonfiction, and children's literature, including To the End of the Land, a meditation on war, family, and loss, which the New York Times called one of the few novels that feels as though they have made a difference to the world. His many international honors include the French Order of Arts and Letters, Israel's Emmet Prize, and the 2018 Israel Prize, which he'll accept in just a few days. This afternoon, David will be in conversation with Carlin Romano, critic at large, Chronicle of Higher Education, former literary critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and author of America, the Philosophical. Please join me in welcoming David Grossman and Carlin Romano to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you all for coming. It's the first time I've done one of these at 12 o'clock on a Friday, so triple thanks to all of you for coming. I know I've been reading David Grossman since the 80s when I became book editor at the Inquirer. I remember I was just telling him, reviewing The Yellow Wind, one of his most important books. And I know my first reaction when I heard about this new novel was maybe a little bit like the character of the judge. Those of you who are not familiar with the novel I'll just mention, it's about a stand-up act for about 2 hours in a little club in Netanya. And the comic who is doing the stand-up has invited a childhood friend, a retired district court judge, to attend. And when that comic is inviting him on the phone, the first reaction of the judge is, "This is not my kind of thing." He really doesn't like stand-up. He says something like, "You people joke about everything." And that was my first reaction, like, "This is not your type of thing." So I guess my first question is, how did you come to this decision that you were going to focus on a stand-up comic more or less unraveling on stage?
First, shalom, and I'm glad to be here again. Toda rabba, baruch hanimtza. You all understand Hebrew?
Yeah. Let's do it in Hebrew.
I had the idea for the story, the heart of the story, for many years. I think in the beginning of the 90s, when I was researching for another book of mine, the book of Intimate Grammar, I came across a person who used to be a good friend when we were kids in the same shikun, the same building project. And he was... he was sent, like most of us have in the age of 14 or 15, to a kind of a semi-military camp in the south of Israel, in the Negev. Like my character, he suddenly was invited to the barrack of the commander of the camp. I should tell you, it's a strange idea, this semi-military. At the age of 14, they send you to learn how to shoot a gun and to throw a hand grenade and to crawl and to camouflage yourself. All the usual things that a normal child should know in order to to be prepared for real life. Mm. This guy, my friend, was invited to the barrack of the commander, and he was told that he has to go immediately back to Jerusalem to the funeral. And nobody told him who died. And actually, my story is very much like that. There is this guy, Dovale Greenstein, the only child of two parents who are tormented and tormenting people. And they are very symbiotic family, the three of them. He calls it the Bermuda Triangle. Everyone who enters dies. my Dovale, this is the name of the main character, of course he does not want to leave his parents. He is afraid of what will happen to them if he just leaves home for more than a day. But he has to go there. And then one day he is invited and to the commander and was told, go out. There is a funeral at 4 o'clock and all his belongings are packed and he's put on a military vehicle. And off he goes to Jerusalem, which is 4 hours drive with a military driver. And only one question has not been asked. Who died? Who died? And during the way, of course, he starts to feel that it's on him to decide who will die. And then his mama and papa starts to quarrel and to argue and to beg for him. Each one wants to spare himself or herself, and it becomes almost violent in his mind. And then he decides. He makes a decision, and his great tragedy in life is that his decision became true. The one he chose to die actually died, and all his life he lives with this sense of guilt, and it changed totally his being and his character. And he's a person that had to put upon himself layers on layers of rudeness and vulgarity and aggression. And by the way, this is one of the things that led him to be a stand-up comedian, because as a stand-up comedian, he can do all these things, and it's legal. You know, there is the show starts and the book starts when he jumps or being kicked into the stage, and he starts to flirt with the audience and flatter to the audience and tease the audience, and they are acting back, and all the rules of this tango are very well known to both parties. And there are two people in the audience that are not the usual audience. One is the judge. The judge is someone who was with my Dovale when they were in this youth camp in the Negev, and he betrayed him then. He was able to save him. He was able to ask for Dovale the question. Dovale was shy or intimidated by the situation. He was a child. The child that later will become the judge was able to ask, and he did not ask. He belonged to this, you know, decision to be indifferent. And when I wrote it, I realized how much indifference is a very cunning form of cruelty. Because, you know, there are not dead people bleeding on the stage, someone with a knife in his back. No, but somebody is killed always. I mean, the fact that you are turning a blind eye when you see a wound of someone is really cruel. And so this is one, the ex-judge that Dovale invites after 43 years, they were totally apart. But there is another one. There is a woman, a very, very small woman, and a kind of a borderliner. She came because she thought that stand-up comedy is karaoke. And she was quite disappointed. But there was something else. When he enters the stage, her jaw, you say, drops. With amazement, because she knew him, she recognized him when they both were children in the neighborhood of Romema in Jerusalem. And then he spots her, and he does not recognize her. And she starts to remind him that they were children together in this neighborhood. And then she adds 4 words in Hebrew, Aval hayita yele tov, but you were a good boy. And these simple, naive, primal words, they crack him open. And the person that he has suffocated or denied or oppressed all these years bursts out of him with the story that he had to bury inside himself. And here is the story. I mean, here is the situation in which he is desperate to share his most intimate story with foreigners, with people who are indifferent, again, I will say, to his misery. But all the time he has to bribe them because they want to be entertained. They came to wash their brains, as we say in Hebrew, lishtof tamoach. And suddenly they have to listen to a very demanding sad story. They don't want it. So all the time when he feels that the suspense or the tension of them is being reduced a little, he throws them another joke and another joke, you know, like you keep a fire on all the time. And okay, the rest is in the story.
Mm-hmm.
If there is some rest, yeah. No, there is a lot of rest.
To me, one of the surprises of the book, when I had read about it before, I thought it would be just a continuing monologue of Dove. And instead, it's in the voice of the judge, and the judge's observations on what's happening on stage, to me, really provide a texture for understanding what's happening on stage. Did you, at some point in writing it, begin to think, this is not just about the person on stage, this is very much about the person telling the story also, and revelatory about him?
It's always like that, yeah. I think. If I look at books that I've written in my life, almost in all of them there is somebody that tells a story to another human being. Mm. And I'm really interested in what happens, the chemistry and the relationship that are created while telling a story for the first time, or sometimes an old story being retold to another person. How the listening of the other person recreates the story, but also how we are being changed if we tell an old story in a new way. Because I feel that usually we have our personal stories, our legislative stories, that we know how to tell to strangers. And over the years, we have polished them, and we know to tell them in a way that will gain us the sympathy and empathy and the love of other people who we meet. And maybe at a certain point, we should ask ourselves, is this story really relevant to me today? Maybe I'm no more in the situation that I was when I had to create this official story that I will give to a new person, like a visit card of myself. Maybe I'm not there anymore. Maybe I can allow myself to look differently at the things that have tormented me and were cast in cement inside me. Maybe I can, you know, massage my formal stories and be more liberated within it. Maybe, you know, just for example, if I'm telling a story about how my parents mistreated me, maybe now, at a certain age, I'm in a position to say, hey, you know, even parents have the right to have psychology. You know, they have their motivations as well. And as I am understanding and tuned to all the needs of myself, all the nuances, I should be tuned and listening and caring for their nuances. Mm-hmm. And by the way, when I say it, I think that not only individuals become trapped and maybe even imprisoned or victims of their official story, but also societies and nations. Mm. And every nation probably has its legislative stories, which were very important at the time when they were created. The nations and societies, they need models, bigger than life models. But maybe after a while it's useful to go back and to check our myths, national myths, and maybe we shall be liberated and not become the victims of our own story. Because you see nations, you see, for example, I think of Israel, of course, but there are other nations who become victim of these myths, and they block them, and they do not allow them to progress and to behave differently.
You know, I want to ask you about a subject that I don't think is the subject that drove you to write this book, stand-up comedy, but, you know, your comments just now make me think of the comparison between stand-up comedy in the United States and Israel. So in the book, Dove many times turns to, I guess, the manager, Yoav, and says, "I know, no politics, you're not supposed to do any politics." Now, in the U.S., I would say stand-up comics are divided. You have super successful ones, like the late-night hosts or Jerry Seinfeld, who seem very confident, their life has worked out. And some of them do politics. We have someone, Stephen Colbert, he does politics all the time. Others not. Recently, one, Jimmy Kimmel, has been drawn into a lot of political discussion after his child had to have heart surgery, only weeks old, and so on. I'm curious, when you were doing this amazing performance where Dove is telling standard jokes, some of them fall flat, some of them are tasteless, and he's constantly riffing that I'm not going to do politics, is stand-up comedy different in Israel in that you are supposed to not get into the settlers and anything that could divide the audience? You're supposed to just ignore that as you talk about your mother-in-law or something?
I agree with you. I think, first I have to say, I have never been to any performance of stand-up comedy in my life.
Even in Israel?
Never, never.
He's famous as a researching journalist.
However, you cannot be a person of our era without being exposed to stand-up on television, of course. So I saw Sarah Silverman and Louis C.K., if we may mention his name,
and he unraveled,
and of course Seinfeld, and of course some Israeli stand-up comedians like Adi Ashkenazi, who is really great. And the great stand-up comedians are those who are not afraid of talking about the harsh problems, the real problems. I'm afraid to say that usually what I saw on television again is very mild. It's not really a daring. And you know, they go on the safe side, jokes about the mother-in-law. Yeah, that's very easy, a cheap shot, and you immediately get people laugh when you just say these words. I'm looking for stand-up comedians, and I'm looking for comic writers whom, when I read them, I feel that the earth is moving under my feet. You know, that suddenly they take me to a place that is not secure. Not only that it's not a comfort zone of me, but it's really a place of horror. And I hope my Dovale does the same thing. You know, he starts with mild, tasteless jokes, and sometimes he gets to places, you know, he makes his audience, for example, cheer to death, yes, and to clap. And they are taken by him as if he hypnotizes them by finding the exact place in them, the really exact fiber where they will be inflamed by the horrible idea of death, but suddenly they belong to death for some seconds, and it embarrasses them. He's able to do things to them like a good hypnotizer almost. And that, I think, what stand-up comedians should do for us.
Yeah, no, I think you really achieved that. I remember one part early in the book when he has a riff on, just imagine if we could do whatever we want in this country, do what we want to the Palestinians, do. And you feel that coming from the audience in a very uncomfortable way. That works perfectly. I was astonished, too, at the work of your translator. I mean, turning what is supposed to be a performance in Hebrew in the small club into a kind of rat-a-tat English that really works. It sounds like it could be somebody in Vegas. I mean, did you work with her on that?
Yes, Jessica Cohen, my wonderful translator. I work with her because English is the only language except Hebrew and some Arabic that I can read and have some knowledge of. But in this book, and also in the previous one, in Falling Out of Time is a book, just in two words, and then I explain why I say it. It's a book about loss. How do we experience a loss of a child, of a son or a daughter? And part of it is written in the form of poems, and part in the form of libretto or radio play. And I felt that in both Falling Out of Time and here with this book, with the horse, I need a more tight contact with my translators. And I did something I never did before. I gathered 15 of my translators in a small a translation center in a little village on the border between Germany and Holland. There is a special center for translation. The town is called Strahlen. And they have, in this house, they have 24,000 volumes of dictionaries from each language to each language. And there will be a dictionary for terminology of perfumes in France in the 18th century and shipyard terms in Britain from the 19th century and dictionaries of curses. Funny thing, I realized that in every language, I don't know how it works in English, but in Hebrew and Arabic it works. When we use curses, we prefer to use the language of our enemy. Not to pollute our own language. Each of us, of the 15 translators and the writer, which I find is a very good beginning to a horror movie or something like that. In the end, they kill the writer, and we don't know who of the translators did it. But they all have an interest, believe me.
Okay.
And each one of us got a library in his or her room, a library of a well-known person, a story character, and I got, for I don't know what reason, the library of Marquis de Sade, which was really eye-opening in many ways. And I sat there, we sat there for a week, and I would read a paragraph or a page or a scene from the book, and then I stopped. I paused and I waited and I started to hear the murmuring. And we made them sit together, the sister languages, the Slovakian languages, the Norwegian, the Anglo-Saxon, all this. And they started to consult amongst themselves and to say, maybe this word will be accurate. And they gave advice to each other. It was so beautiful. And you could also have seen the way translation is... first of all, it's a mystery. How is it possible to translate something? I write in Hebrew. Almost in every paragraph I write, there is some allusion or connotation from the Bible or from more ancient Hebrew than now or from the time of the Enlightenment. It's always it's there. I'm not even aware of that sometimes. And how can a very talented translator take it to another field of meaning, because it arouses in English, in Japanese, in whatever language, it arouses other connotations and other particles are surfacing to the awareness of the reader. And also, not only the psychology or the mentality of the languages is different, but also the mentality of the translator. So many times it happened that my German translator, Anne Birkenauer, the wonderful one, she said, oh no, this part, this sentence is so sentimental, it's almost kitsch. And immediately the Catalan and the Italian and the Spanish translators jumped and said, no, it's not sentimental, it's emotional, it's exactly, it is the right temperature to it. Mm-hmm. So for example, in Hebrew there is one word for fetus, for embryo. We say ubar. Ubar, there are no more words, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, to the word ubar, but I think in Romanian or Slovakian, there are three different words for three different phases of the pregnancy for the ubar, and they wanted to know exactly. And there are languages that you do not address people in the second form, but on the third, you know. And how can a stand-up comedian stand in front of an audience and talk with the third person, not in the second person? So all these were such challenges, and the week there that we have all spent, which was really a life, wonderful experience of just doing the most spiritual thing. And I think it helped enormously the translation of all these languages. And now, whenever there is a new country, a new language that wants to translate the book, part of the contract is that they have to consult with one of the persons who was in Strahlen.
Wow, wonderful.
Yeah.
I think I hear the next novel, Murder in a Border Village. Murder on the European expressed. Right? Well, no, that's wonderful. I remember years ago, Umberto Eco saying, you know, that The Name of the Rose was a different book in every language, because I remember the example he gave was that he told his German translator to use more Latin because they were better educated in Latin, and the American translator to use much less because we don't know anything. So I'm wondering, and I know you don't like to go into these areas very much, but I think all of us who have been reading you, you know, over the years, even though you don't like being called the conscience of Israel and things like that, you've always been we know you are a very wise observer of what goes on there and what's going to happen and so on. And so I feel that all of us would like to know, as you see what's happened recently, the move of the embassy that's coming to Jerusalem, what happened at the Gaza border recently, do you have much hope that things will get better rather than worse? I mean, how are you feeling recently?
Do we have to ruin a nice morning by talking about it?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the theme of your book, that everything gets a little ruined when you turn to reality.
I don't have much hope. I think the situation aggravates constantly. There is not one gram of goodwill on part of both parties, the Israeli and the Palestinians. There is a deep sense of hopelessness on both sides. I'll talk about Israel. There is a lot to talk about the Palestinians and the way they behave in the conflict, but I think I would leave it to a Palestinian. I'll talk about Israel and our leaders. And I feel that the situation makes us less and less democratic, more and more nationalist and fundamentalist. It's almost inevitable that such a process happens in a society that feels threatened. You know, we have a prime minister who is really a genius in the way he knows how to mix together the real dangers that Israel faces, and we do face real dangers, don't get me wrong. There are people who do not want, people and peoples who do not want Israel to exist there. We cannot ignore that. But Mr. Netanyahu knows in a very primal way how to mix together the real dangers with the echoes of past trauma. And we, the Israelis, being a traumatized society, and we are a traumatized society, we are totally helpless in front of such manipulation. And the fact that we are at the same time a very strong superpower, we are the greatest superpower in the region, including Iran, and yet we feel weak, we feel fragile, we feel the victim of the situation, not the creator of, even not of a part of the situation. And there is a deep reluctance in the heart of many in Israel, I don't know if it's a majority, to even listen to voices from the other side, let it be from the left or voices from the Palestinians. And there is not any willingness even to talk about our responsibility to the situation. I'm not talking about feeling guilt regarding some parts of the conflict. Today is Friday. On Tuesday, there will be a very interesting and meaningful meeting in Tel Aviv of an organization that is called the Forum, the Israeli-Palestinian Bereaved Families. And I find it a very important organization. Both Israelis and Palestinians who lost their beloved ones in wars, in terror attacks, and they decided that enough is enough, that this war cannot be won, and that they prefer to use their energy and wisdom in order to achieve peace, to act sometimes against the natural, even normal behavior of someone who has been hurt and he wants to hurt back. and to kill back, if not the one who actually killed his son, so one from the people of those who killed his son, or from the religion who killed his son, or from the race who killed his son. And it's really an act against the temptation to hate. And there is a temptation to hate, you know. Because when you hate, suddenly the picture of the world is very clear to you. And it's very simple. It's dichotomized between we, the good ones, they, the devils. It's so easier to behave when you think like that. It's, by the way, so much more difficult and complicated to be a leftist in all over, I think, but especially in our conflict. Because as a leftist, you have to contain contradictions. You have to be critical and realistic about the mistakes and the crimes of the Palestinians, and yet you have to fight with all your power in order to achieve peace with them, hoping that this will change both them and ourselves, and we shall be able to formulate to ourselves, maybe for the first time in our history of the last 2,000 years, the option of having peace, of living life of peace, of allowing ourselves to give up gradually, it will take generations, on the fear, on the existential fear that is so deeply rooted in ourselves. So on Tuesday, as we do every year in the last 13 years, there will be a gathering. It was supposed to be a gathering of us, the bereaved Israeli families, with 120, maybe even more Palestinians who are part of this organization, who every day of the year they can come even to Israel and they go. There are always pairs, one Israeli, one Palestinian. They go in schools, they go in all kinds of institutes that allow them to go together. Not all of them and not even half of them allow them to go together and to talk to the kids, to the pupils. But every day of the year they can enter. When it comes to Tuesday, the memorial day of the people who fell in war in Israel, our Minister of Defense, Mr. Avigdor Lieberman, forbids them to have a permit to come. So again, we shall be in Tel Aviv, they will be in Beit Jalla or Bethlehem or wherever, and we shall communicate like that. As if Mr. Lieberman is afraid of the option that Israelis will hear another voice, that their basic premises would be, you know, shaken. I find it a major mistake, because if we hear only ourselves, if we echo to ourselves only what we already think and know and afraid of, then we are not in contact with reality. We are really in contact only with a kind of a wishful thinking or a kind of a nightmare that we nourish and develop. You cannot redeem yourself from such a situation, and again, you become a victim of the situation rather than shape it in a way that will allow you and your children and grandchildren life. What we have now is only survival. We are great survivors. We the Jews, throughout our history, we survived to live our life, and now we live to survive only. And okay, if you are in extermination camp, that's what you want to do, to survive at any price from moment to moment. But when you are the greatest superpower in the region and all you hope for is just to survive from one catastrophe to the next, this is not enough. It's not enough. Life can offer much more than that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think, I mean, certainly the aspiration of that gathering you speak of seems to me a ray of hope, even though it's clearly been blocked. But you make me ask you a follow-up question, really, because I see a linkage between what's happening in the book, the idea that you don't talk about politics so we can pretend we're all on the same page in this room, even though there may be settlers and there may be people on the left and so on. You, I think, faced quite a dilemma recently with the Israel Prize. As I understand it, a few years ago when Netanyahu got himself involved in the Israel Prize, and I do read the Israeli papers, you withdrew your name because he was trying to get rid of a couple of judges. My understanding, maybe I'm wrong, is that next Wednesday is the ceremony?
Next Thursday.
And that part of accepting the Israel Prize for Literature is that you shake hands with Netanyahu and you shake hands with a bunch of other members of the government. And I read in Haaretz over in February, over 2 days, somebody wrote an article, David Grossman, don't accept the Israel Prize. And then 2 days later, someone else wrote, David Grossman, accept the Israel Prize. This must have been some dilemma for you. Did you decide that if we're not going to hate the other, I don't want to do this sort of gesture where I won't shake hands? Or maybe you've decided you're going to show up, but you're not going to shake hands? I mean, how did you resolve this tension?
It is a dilemma, but, I mean, look at the picture, then turn it upside down or to the other side. I will have to shake the hand of Netanyahu, but he also will have to shake my hand. And, you know, I tell you frankly, the easiest way for me would have been to avoid being there at all. I don't like it. I think that if you are absent from a place, it's less meaningful than being there and, if I may say so, represent a certain voice in Israel that is being so attacked and even humiliated in the last years. And I see from reactions of people and for really many, many letters and mails and reactions on the street that there are people who feel that the things that I write and the things that I say, they represent something that they want to be there, to be present. It will be probably, I will be probably the only representative of this voice there. And the Israel Prize is, for me, a very meaningful prize. I mean, I feel really proud to belong to this chain of Hebrew writers who document our life, who try to decode the codes of the Israeli behavior, the different dialects of thoughts and mind of Israelis. And for me, it's also a great privilege to write in Hebrew. Hebrew is a very ancient language, you know. It counts back something like 3,500 years. And like in every ancient language, all the residues of the people in those years is kept in the language. I for 27 years now, every once a week I study the Bible with two other friends, with a man and a woman, and we are trio, and we study the Bible. And it's a wonderful experience. I am an atheist. I'm a non-believer, a devoted non-believer Jew. But the Bible is not only a religious text. It's, of course, a religious, but it's a cultural, it's a linguistic text, it's a psychological text. It's so interesting. We are doing what Jews used to do throughout the history of the Jewish people, which is we read the Bible with magnifying glass. And sometimes it takes us weeks to stay on one or two or three verses from the Bible and to understand it and to go to all the connotations and all the free-floating that the Bible creates, and it does create, because it is such a condensed text, the most condensed text that exists at all. I'll give you a small example. You know, there's the story about Jacob, Leah, and Rachel. I hope you remember from the Bible. Jacob loved Rachel, the beautiful Rachel, but her father gave to him, after he worked for him 7 hard years of slavery, her father, at the night of the wedding, instead of bringing Rachel to the wedding tent, he brought Leah. And the Bible says, in Hebrew I will first say it in Hebrew, Vayehi baboker vehinehi Leah. Vayehi baboker vehinehi Leah. 5 words. And in the morning, there she was, Leah. Now, today, a modern writer would have written a whole novel about this night. A whole novel about this night. And with all the layers and everything, the Bible, it's enough for him that, you know, Thomas Mann, when in Joseph and his brother, he said that they made love 9 times this night. 9 times, yes. I see your faces. I mean, they had other system of calculation. I mean, it's exactly like Methuselah lived 960.
Maybe he's including the brothers.
Yeah.
The I do want to ask you one follow-up question before I open it to the audience about the situation with the prize. So I was struck, again, reading about the prize, that Naftali Bennett, who would not seem to be one of your great fans, a port minister in Israel, said some very lovely things about you as he announced that prize, and was criticized by lots of people on the right, and said something that I guess we would like people to say, trying to breach all the partisanship in Israel, as in the United States, saying, yeah, you know, we don't agree. Of course, we don't agree on a lot of policy things, but he is a great writer, and he's a moving writer, and it's my honor to give this. I don't know if you think he was being cynical or sincere, but I was curious how you felt about the way he handled the prize.
He was very sincere. I mean, when he called me, I don't want to give away the content and his behavior. He was very moved. I could have judged by his voice and by the things he said to me privately and later openly. And, you know, I think part of the disease of our situation is that we are almost doomed to generalize and to stereotype and to deny the right of the other to multi-layeredness. Yeah? I know quite a few settlers. Now, settlers are portrayed as demons. I deeply disagree with these people. I think they are an existential danger to Israel, the people and the whole idea of the settlements. They might prevent us from achieving a viable peace because of the places that settlements were planted deliberately to block and to prevent a possibility of future peace. And yet, when you know a human being, and when you are yourself a human being, when you are not just a hermetic person, you feel different radiations from a human being. And you feel that there are places where we think alike and places that we differ totally. And for me, it is important also to be in contact with people who are totally the opposite of me. Because I do feel that they evocate something that could have been me. You know, I was born into a family that many of them are settlers, are in the occupied territories. And my uncle, the brother of my mother, was for years the general secretary of the Mafdal, the National Religious Party in Israel. So I know them. I know their vocabulary. I know their emotional voltage. I know how deeply they love Israel. They love Israel. What can I say? I mean, it's not the kind of love that I like, but it's the way they love. And I don't want to deny it. I mean, it makes life more complicated for me. It was easier just to hate, you know. It's easier to hate, as I said before. But I, you know, I want to be in my situation, to be with capital B, and to be with capital B means to be exposed to all kinds of radiation.
Thank you. I want to open it up to questions in the audience now.
Okay. Thank you.
And when I call on you, please wait for the microphone. Yeah, right, and we start here.
Thank you very much. Wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Are any of your works translated into Arabic? And if so, how widespread is the readership?
Four of my books are translated to Arabic. There are two books that I wish will be translated. One is To the End of the Land, and one is See Under Love. It's a book about, generally speaking, about the Shoah, about how is it possible to continue to live after the Shoah, to believe after the Shoah, to have children, to bring children to such a world after the Shoah. These books are not being translated. I just hope that if ever in the future they are translated, the reader in the Arab world will be able to understand us a little more. I think in most Arab countries, the way Israel is portrayed is monolithic, is hermetic, is stereotypical and cliché-like. And I think, books have this ability to massage the cliché. Yes, and to put it to its fibers. I wish this will happen. I got quite a few reactions to my books from Arab countries. also to the end of the land and see on the lab when people read them in English translation. And one of the reactions really touched me. I think it was in the biggest Arab paper out of Arab country, any Arab country, El Hayat in London. And there was an academician, a professor, I don't remember his name, who wrote that when you read this story, you understand that the love of the Israelis to their land is authentic. And I thought it's a very meaningful reaction, because usually they regard us as a kind of, you know, a branch of Western colonialism, which is a mistake. I mean, we are not there because we are colonialists. It's important to stress this point. We are there because we originated there more than 3,000 years ago as a people, as a religion, as a culture, as a language. And the longing to go back there was a major component of our identity and of our being. Wherever we were, you know, we have been into 70 diasporas, we used to say, but the thing that really united us was the longing towards Zion, towards Jerusalem. I mean, the Arabs must understand that. Without this understanding, it will be very hard to develop deep, sincere relationship in the future. It will not be easy, as for us, to accept the way that they love Palestine and the way they want to go back to their places. There will have to be a change in the way, in the narratives of both peoples. You know, each people has a narrative. And we spoke before about the narratives that become the trap to the people. But when two narratives collide, in this place, flowers will never flourish from this place. It's a hermetic, rigid place. And what, for example, we try to do in this forum of the families is to massage the narrative. Again, this way, to massage, you know, to make it human story again, because I feel that the narrative is a human story that has congealed. And if we want to solve a problem, a human problem, we have to withdraw or to go deeper into the human level of it. I will be happy to answer literary questions, by the way.
Yeah. All right. We have a hand right here.
I haven't read A Horse Walks Into a Bar yet, but To the End of the Land is one of my favorite books. And the basic idea, there's some magical thinking by the protagonist. She thinks that if she is not home, that the soldiers who might come to say that her son has been killed, that she can prevent her son from dying by not being home. This is a bit of magical thinking. So in your summary of the new book, I hear again another piece of magical thinking, that the boy can decide who has died. So can you just speak about the role of magical thinking and how it's, and the commonness or difference of these two situations, and just how that has come into these works?
I think all of us, we have our small points of magical thinking. Of course, if you are a believer, you have also a magical thinking. I mean, it's kind of magical thinking. But I am interested in magical thinking that drive people to act, to move, not only to be stuck in the magical thinking. Dovale is more of a tragic hero because he is trapped, because it happened to him when he was a child, and all his psychology locked around this trip that he did to the funeral of either Papa and Mama, and the guilt that he took upon himself, even though it was imposed on him. But Ora is not only a passive magical thinker. She acts, because suddenly it pierces her that it takes two for bad news, one to deliver and one to receive. And what if she's not there to receive? You know, she feels she has to do something. She cannot just be there like a sitting duck to the notifiers, and they, you know, they come at any given hour when they get confirmation for the fall of your beloved one, and they knock at the door and they throw it in your face. This is the method. And she decides she will not be there to take it. And she runs out of home. And on her way, she sweeps Avram, who was the love of her youth and the love of her life. And he, when he was 16, he was like a volcano of ideas and passion and humor and imagination. And when he was 21, he fell captive at the hands of the Egyptians in the war of 73, the Yom Kippur War. They tortured him, and he came back totally painful. If he had 1 gram of energy, he would have killed himself, but he has not, and he can only be surprised why life insists on him so much. And the only person he really has some contact with is Ora. And she, on her way, she runs away from home to the Galilee, and she takes Avram with her, and she starts to talk about Ofer, about the son that is now being at war in one of the military operations in the West Bank. And gradually we realize that she chose Avram, who is not her husband, to come with her because he is the biological father of this son, of Ofer. And she has this idea that if his mother and father are talking about him, in a way they infuse something, some life or vitality or energy into him, into his veins. So this will sustain him when he's out there in the war. And she goes there and she talks about the smallest things of upbringing of a child, of the accumulation of a human being in this world, from the moment he was born and the moment he stood up on his feet for the first time. And I think every one of us noticed this miraculous moment when suddenly the child stands and he's amazed, and suddenly the noise has come from an unexpected place, and the way he sees things and all the way he occupies space is suddenly different. It's a mutation almost. And how they together, she and Ofer, how they made homework in mathematics, and both of them had no clue of mathematics. But together, and after they were irritated by each other and teasing each other, but because they were together, they were able to solve the mathematic equation. And I thought that in the middle of a reality of war, where she is now, Ora, when the air is full with trumpets and drums and slogans, and the prime minister speaks in deeper and deeper voice, and there are all the echoes of the greatness, the euphoric moments that the war provides, suddenly she comes and she infiltrates small, primal, intimate words, the basic words of a mother to a child. This is why I wanted a mother to be the main character of the book. The locomotive of the book. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what I have to say.
Thanks. A brief two-part question. Last summer I was at Netanya Academic College for a few weeks. So I was wondering, when I walked around after having read your book, was your nightclub modeled after any nightclub in Netanya? And the second part is, how was your book received by the residents of Netanya itself?
When the book came out, we found on our answering machine at home, I think 3 or 4 angry messages from people who identified themselves as people of Netanya, angry people of Netanya. They said, "Ani toshav nizam shel Netanya," and they said that I've blackened their city. And but I think now, when the book is published in 45 languages, maybe they feel that Netanya got some respect in the world.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question. The comment is, you were talking about how telling one's story out loud to an audience can transform you, and you can transform your story, your understanding of yourself, which is a kind of very succinct summary of what happens in psychotherapy. So I really appreciated that. My question is, and this also involves an audience and the plot of A Horse Walks Into a Bar, the judge is the childhood friend who is the one invited, known member of the audience for the performance. Could you talk a bit about your hero's motivation for inviting him and the role he played in their interaction. My book group thought they actually both transformed one another during the course of the evening.
I absolutely agree with that. He comes first, as it was mentioned, reluctantly. He hates stand-up. He's a very grumpy, bitter person. He lost his wife a year and a half ago and is still mourning her. And he hardly remembers Dovale. I mean, he had to suppress with many layers of forgetfulness the event that happened in the south of Israel. And then he comes, and at the beginning, when Dovale starts to tell, to direct the story towards this semi-military camp, he wants to run away, the judge, because he feels he's not a judge now, but an accused. But then he realized another thing. And I think this is an interesting turn for me as a writer when I was writing it. And I understood something from it, because books teach writers that, I mean, had Dovale accused the judge directly, the judge was almost doomed to hit back or to entrench or to act aggressively as a defense of himself. Dovale does not accuse him. He describes the moment of guilt. And he puts it somewhere between them. And the judge can relate to it and go back and to test himself. How has he behaved? Did he behave well or not? Did he betray him or not? Why has he betrayed him? Is he willing now to feel remorse? Because, you know, there is another thing about guilt. Quite often we say we are guilty. Yeah, we are guilty of this and that. And we feel very good as if we purify ourselves by saying it. But maybe we just, you know, we just throw it as a lip service and do not really explore the guilt. And it becomes like a stone that blocks the mouth of a well. Because maybe underneath this guilt there are more things and more layers and more options of our behavior. And there is a moment in the story when the audience starts to be really aggressive towards Dovale and they urge him to tell jokes, come on, tell us jokes. And then suddenly the judge rises and he's a very impressive man and he shouts, "Tnu lo lesaper et hasipur shelo," let him tell his story. And Dovale is so deeply touched because there is a kind of a repairment of a tikkun in the behavior of the judge 43 years later, but it's, tikkun is always actual and relevant. And suddenly the judge acts as the bigger brother of Dovale. And this allows, I think, the reuniting of not only of Dovale and the judge as good friends in the end of the book, but, you know, Dovale belongs to this kind of people who, because something that happened to them in the past, because of fear from life, because of many, many, many things, reasons, he lives in parallel to the life he should have lived. There are people, we see people who are stuck in the wrong profession and all their life they work in a profession that they hate and it humiliates them, but they adjust, they know how to function. We are all creative people. You see people who are trapped in the wrong marriage, present company excluded, of course. We are angels here. I'm talking about Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. And they torment each other and they suffer every moment and yet they stay together because they have some reasons to stick together. Or people who are stuck in the wrong gender and they do not dare to move to another gender. And we are flexible creatures, we humans, so we know how to build ourselves the parallel life, and we nest very efficiently in this parallel life. But from time to time, the real authentic life, I feel, keeps sending pulses of insult, of pain, of grief, because somebody has been murdered there. And what is so, I think, redeeming about literature, that it can give us a second chance. You know, that suddenly in literature, Dovale, in the end of the story, is able to unite with his real self, the only asset that we really have, our real self. And once he does that, and once the judge does the same or feels the same thing, now they are able to meet again as if they were before the trauma, at the time when they really used to be themselves. Thank you for the question.
A translation question. And I hope I'm not sounding chauvinistic as an American reader. A horse walks into a bar. It seems like that is a truly American construct, or it comes from us. How did it, with all your 45 translators,
how did it work
with 45 other countries, other languages?
I think in all languages, it's called a horse walks into a bar, except in the Italian that somehow they call it applausi alla scena vuota, applauses to an empty stage. Which, I mean, it's not bad, but it's, the title is the beginning of a very famous, it's not only one joke, but there are hundreds of jokes about, and by the way, it's the only joke in the book, there are many jokes in the book, but the only one who is not concluded, you know, it's a horse walks into a bar, okay, and then Dovele thinks about something else, and people ask me, okay, what's the end of the joke? So a horse walks into a bar. He comes to the barman and he says, give me a chaser of vodka. Barman looks at him, okay, pours the vodka, horse drinks. How much is that? Barman says, $50. $50, okay. Horse pays, goes to the exit. The barman chases him. Excuse me, Mr. Horse, it's amazing. I'm stunned. I never saw something like that. A talking horse. So the horse looks at him and tells him, with your prices, you will never see again.
David Grossman, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.